Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Josh.
Hey, Mom.
Are you at the computer?
I am.
Okay. All right. Well, it's time to get started.
So you have a computer as well today?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
So I'm going to go in and record, and I'll be back and say hello.
Okay.
Hi, everybody. This is Polly and Josh.
Hello.
This is our Tuesday evening call, which means that for our people in Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, that part of the world, it's actually tomorrow, and they should be, it's tomorrow morning, and so they should be able to get on this call. Okay. Josh, you ready to get started with the questions?
I am ready to get started.
Okay. Hi, I'm 16, I go to a therapist, and a while ago she told me I have anxiety, mostly social but general as well. Today, I feel like it hit an all-time high. I understand that I will have bad days, but my days have turned into almost 2 weeks. I remember that. I'm a senior and luckily go to an online flexible school because I've had no motivation to do any work. Is there any pointers to help me control it so I can get schoolwork done?
Well, yeah, good news. You're at the very beginning of this process, which means it's actually pretty easy to turn around. There's kind of two sides to what she's describing, where we would start. The generalized anxiety is, you know, kind of our bread and butter sort of here at the Breakthrough Program. And that's a big deal. There's a sort of fatigue that happens when anxiety runs through your life. At least for me, it was during all of my waking hours. For some people, it's closer to 24/7. So what we mean by generalized anxiety is when there's just that constant anxiety present. It might rise and fall. In fact, it probably does for all of us throughout the day. But, you know, pretty much every time you check in on yourself throughout the day, there's some level of anxiety there. And it can get pretty annoying. That's kind of an understatement. It can get downright devastating, kind of depending on where it's at as far as how strong. That's the piece to this puzzle that I don't think standard medicine really figured out, how to tackle generalized anxiety very well. You know, what we found here is that when you get certain nutritional things worked out, a lot of that can get taken care of, and taken care of in a way that doesn't have side effects, doesn't cause other problems, you're not taking medication.
Obviously, this person, he or she, has been going to a therapist, and it jumped up. And I know that for me, back in the 70s, I think we spent $20,000 one year on therapy, and it didn't get anywhere. It's not that the therapy wasn't good. I did learn techniques. I did learn different things in my life and things to do, but it didn't take care of my body sensations.
Yeah. And without that, you know, it's really hard to put the therapy to work.
Like backslide, and it's like in your mind you're going, oh my gosh, I did what she said or he said, and here it's right back again. I thought I had it under control, and then wham, it hits you.
Yeah, if we're trying to treat, I view and generalized anxiety in particular, like asthma or diabetes, and trying to go to your therapist for asthma, are there techniques that you could use? Actually, there are, but it's just the wrong tool. And unfortunately, we're taught in our culture that that's the toolkit you're supposed to use. This is a psychological problem, so you're supposed to go to the psychological field and find your solution. There are elements of anxiety that are psychological, and I'll speak to that. But, if you're suffering from generalized anxiety, we've found that there's a strong genetic correlation there, and this is a strongly physical problem. Over time, I think the scientific community, the medical community, will come around on this. But for now, it's kind of like brand new information, and maybe for some of you, you're hearing it for the first time.
Yeah, this is. We've known it for many years, but it's just starting to come out. I'm just hearing people say that their psychiatrist or whatever is saying that it's genetic, and kind of they haven't gotten to the root like we think we have, but it is starting to become general information somewhat.
Yeah, I want to speak to the second half of her question. I'm going to say her. that is the social anxiety. Certainly, by the way, there's this attitude in the culture that anxiety is predominantly a female problem, and I just don't buy that. You know, my clientele is about 50-50. I think that men tend to not report this as much. So when you read a statistic about, you know, 70, 80, 90% of us being female, I just think that people not being willing to go seek help or report themselves as having anxiety. That being said, you know, the idea is that social anxiety is being mentioned here. It's very common, and that is in the scope of psychology. We can look at our views of others, what we think others are thinking about us, how we interact, what we think catastrophic outcomes would look like if we behaved a certain way. We all have our kind of unique spin on that, but that's a common problem for us. I can tell you, however, that the chemistry of generalized anxiety makes our brain more prone to think about those catastrophic outcomes. We rarely have these very rational discussions within ourselves when our anxiety is strong about what would actually most likely really happen. We tend to go to these catastrophic extremes. And anybody who's listening to this call will understand what exactly I'm talking about. They'll recognize right away that when they're worried that maybe they're sick, they're not thinking they have a cold. They tend to go right to, I have cancer or I have multiple sclerosis. We have some kind of catastrophic expectation. When it comes to social stuff, you know, I will be the laughingstock of my group. I will be kicked out. And that's a whole discussion unto itself. But we tend to go catastrophic. And in the future, right now it's a burden. In the future, you'll actually use that as a red flag that lets you know that's your anxiety talking, and that's not a factual statement. That's not an actually true thing.
Right. In social anxiety, too, I guess, like, I'm not an introvert, but I guess at times I could have appeared that mm-hmm. way because I didn't want to go to dances. My mouth would get very dry. If I was in front of people, you know, my nausea, my intestines would gear up. And so I wouldn't want to be in a social situation. I disliked going to school immensely. I loved learning. I disliked the action of going to school and how I would feel, actually how I felt about going to school was even worse, the anticipatory anxiety. So I think a lot of times that's misread. People say, oh, I have social anxiety, and I don't know if that's exactly the right term for it.
Yeah, it certainly could be. You know, myself, I'm I think a couple points higher on the extroversion scale than you generally. But when the anxiety rose in me, yeah, you'd watch my behaviors go more and more introverted looking. And after years and years of this, you can start believing that that's kind of who you are. You know, I was beginning to accept the fact that I wasn't going to have a lot of friends. I wasn't going to do a lot of sort of social or adventurous things. I wasn't going to have a family. And believe me, there's a huge psychological cost to living a life that isn't your own, that living a life so restricted, and especially when you begin to believe that this is actually you and these are your real permanent limitations, that's when the real devastating depression can start to show up. Which I've certainly struggled with, and I understand. So, yeah.
So it's interesting. So. It's interesting, though, to find out who you are, because I never knew if I was in making a decision because it was something I did or didn't want to do, or whether that's who I truly was. So I was always putting limitations and qualifiers on just about everything that I did, and I had no idea who I really was until I came out of it. By the way, I have a workshop that I'm going to. I leave on Thursday, and I'm taking a lady with me, my new assistant, and we'll be gone for 4 days and driving a couple hours both ways.
Right.
We are getting separate rooms because she gets up at 3:30 in the morning for some reason. Although she's definitely touched anxiety. I think I have a rule that we only have people who have had anxiety. I don't know if that's a legal justification for hiring somebody or not, but they have to understand. And then last week I went and had another MRI, and they put you in the tube, and he told me it was going to be a certain amount of time, which was longer than I thought it was going to be, and you're all tight in this tube. And I thought, okay, how am I going to handle this? I had nobody with me. My husband had gone before, and I had freaked out actually one time years ago before we discovered this and actually stopped the MRI and just said, I'm not going to do this anymore, and got out of the MRI and went home. Kind of upsetting not to get the findings that I needed, but there was no way I was staying in there. Anyway, I did it by myself, and I decided to, like, do a puzzle while I was in there. Not, it was a mental puzzle as to how something's going to go and the flow that I needed to go. It was for the workshop this next weekend coming up. And so in my mind, I concentrated on thinking about that. I did open my eyes and looked at the top was about 4, maybe 6 inches from the top of my head. And that was, you know, I was totally enclosed. But anyway, I thought about something. Time passed. And when I got out, I said, oh, my gosh, that couldn't have been that long. And it turned out that it really wasn't as long as he had told me it was going to be. But the time went very quickly, and I was just fine. So big changes in my life. Ready for the next question?
Yeah, I just want to mention that, you know, people get this impression that people who struggle with anxiety are somehow inherently weak, and the reality is just the opposite. You know, if you take our anxiety away, our capacity to do things that maybe other people would find stressful is much higher. So I see that over and over again. I mean, real, quote, normal people struggle with being shoved in an MRI tube. And
right.
You and I, if we just get the anxiety down a little bit, we're fine. You know, I love what I do because when the anxiety, that generalized, that kind of global anxiety starts to diminish, a lot of people just take off. And they start doing stuff that other people might actually find frightening. And away they go.
Yeah, after you've faced this incredible fear-induced chemistry, day after day after day, so many other things seem easy. You know, it's they're very, very, very strong after they come to this oftentimes. Okay, does anyone else suffer from fear of running out of energy? I don't think we've ever had this question before. I find myself scared to do much in case it happens. Sometimes it takes me all day just to get the washing up done. I don't know whether they said that backwards or whether it's a different country. It's always interesting. And I've stopped cooking and eating well. So there's a whole bunch of stuff in there.
Yeah. Okay. You know, first we need, you know, when we have these irrational beliefs, and I can actually understand it, right? You could say the human body, you could imagine, is like a battery, and it gets a charge when we're born, and it will eventually expire. It's not a completely incomprehensible belief. It just happens to be actually backwards. If you look at human longevity, it's, you know, the opposite of that. Those of us who are reasonably active are the ones who live a long time. We are very complicated critters. You know, we need to actually look and challenge these mistaken thoughts. By the way, this one, you know, is unique, but we all have them, actually. Those of us who struggle with anxiety have usually put in place all kinds of mistaken belief systems, and it's my job to listen to those and often to challenge them. In this case, you know, we look at, you know, things like how every cell in our body is actually replaced. We are not this static thing with this one charge. You know, we're constantly taking in energy. And I would work, you know, on this, and I would talk to this person about, I would say, let's actually look at the system. You know, a lot of people will have these fears, and it's my job to stop and say, well, okay, well, let's look at the reality of whatever that is. It could be air travel. It could be illnesses. You know, a lot of people just make up these connections. If I'm using the correct terminology here, conflagration? am I kidding?
I don't know, but our international people have trouble with it for sure.
Yeah, okay.
We can't even say it.
So when
explain
we're
what it
our,
is.
So our brain loves to come up with explanations, even when they're inaccurate. A common example I use is there's a group of people where they've split their brain. And I know that sounds weird, but our two halves of our brain talk through this really cool neural connection. It's like a fiber superhighway that runs down the middle of our brain called the corpus callosum that allows us to have this rapid discussion, if you will, between the left and right hemispheres. So when they sever this, and they do it because people have seizures, and the seizures are migrating across from one side to the other. And if they really can't solve the problem, they will they'll sever this, and for many people it actually is a life-saving surgery. However, you get some really fun physiological characteristics off people who have this. You can do fun things like you can let them see an image through their left eye, which goes to their right brain, and their right brain can't communicate to their left brain. So you can do things like, okay, so in our left brain, is where we do imaginative thinking, big picture stuff, right brain. These are generalizations, but you can do some fun stuff. You can only talk basically through one side of your brain for most people. And so you can put an image through to one side of the brain, the side that can't talk. And the classic example I use is they show an image of a bell. And then they give the person a bunch of pictures, and they say, which of these is a good musical instrument? And there'll be like a violin, a cello, there'll be a church with a steeple, and then there'll be people walking, something that has nothing to do with music. And the person just has this attraction to answering the church with a steeple, with the bell in it. And they don't know why, and instead of saying, oh, I'm a split-brain person, you probably showed me an image that I can't really talk about, that may be kind of drawn to that. We don't do that. We tend, they'll just make something up. They'll just and say, I was on the way to the study today and I passed by this church. It's all a lie. And so when anxiety is present and we are around all the stimuli, we tend to say, oh, it's because of that person in the car with me. That's why I'm anxious. And if your brain says, yeah, that makes sense, it'll settle on that. It'll absolutely lock down that thinking. So it's my job to pull that apart and say, okay, let's challenge that. And so in this case, you know, they would, you know, we challenge it. I love this image. Buckminster Fuller has this idea of human life that we're a knot in a rope. And the rope, imagine it's three different kinds of rope all blended together, like, so there's three sections of, let's say, a hemp rope and then a fiber rope and then, like, a synthetic rope. And you can just slide this knot down, and this flow of energy kind of comes through this knot. And his big question was, you know, what's the knot? That's us. Whatever that is, we're like this organization of energy that's constantly flowing through it. So, yeah, we challenge that idea, and we see if we actually act on that and say, okay, I actually gain energy by eating better. I gain longevity by exercise. And we would try to pick apart that specific that fallacy, that misunderstanding.
Well, actually, what this person is doing is making sure that he or she runs out of energy, because if you look at it, she says, I've stopped cooking and eating well. Well, mm-hmm. Energy comes from food. And one of the big things for us is keeping your blood sugar balanced. And we've talked about that before, so I won't go into that. But anyway, she's making sure, she doesn't realize that she's making sure that her idea is actually being fulfilled. Another thing I wanted to bring up is that lately, I guess because our culture has become so sedentary, they have been doing studies on the value of movement, and they are now starting to equate sitting too long with smoking as a factor in the number of lost years that you will have from that. So all these people and kids particularly are sitting all day long, computers, games, they're not running and playing, and our intestines, our whole body wants us to be up and moving. It's really critical. The muscles, the nerves, the blood vessel, everything wants it to be moving every so many minutes. Even when you're sleeping, you should be turning over in your sleep. And so one of the really hard problems for people who become quadriplegics or paraplegics is the sitting that eventually ends up killing them, because their body just can't move and get things done inside of it. So it's really critical that we move and exercise. And so this running out of energy by moving and by doing things is really dangerous.
Yeah. In this
it's a whole reverse thing that this person is thinking.
Well, we're kind of, you know, talking about how unique this person's model is. But what we have here is a self-fulfilling prophecy. We have the idea that, you know, I have this fear and I'm changing my life and my change of to avoid the fear, and my changes are actually making my fear come true. And we're kind of saying, well, this belief is kind of obviously ridiculous. However, almost everybody who struggles with anxiety has some version of this happening where they have a belief and that reinforces their anxiety, and lo and behold, when they challenge that belief, their anxiety shows back up and they keep reinforcing these, you know, just flat wrong beliefs. And there can be dozens of them all over our life. And that's my job, to kind of hunt them out and challenge them and get that turned around. So that's the cognitive element that I end up working
on. Also, when we put them on the Break Free program, then we teach them how to eat and how to eat correctly. And then the energy naturally starts coming up. But I remember back when I wasn't eating or sleeping, and you talk about how your body was just consuming itself because of your anxiety. Your metabolism was running so high, and you were just dropping weight like crazy. So we absolutely understand kind of where this person's coming from, not specifically that one little bit of fear, but all the chemistry is causing these changes inside their body, and we understand that. Okay.
Sure.
Next one. Hi. I have found that my anxiety heightens when I go on holiday. I don't get anxiety about the holiday, but when I'm there, my anxiety about everything else heightens. I have severe mood swings. I'm convinced my partner is going to leave me. I don't sleep well, and I'm just so up and down. My expectations of how amazing the holiday will be are always left in tatters. We are going to New York in 8 weeks, and I'm worried I'm going to ruin it and not enjoy it. Does anyone else suffer from this? And do you have any tips?
Yeah, by the way, that comes up a lot.
Holidays are tough. Holidays are really tough. It's interesting. This person is a little bit different because I generally see people with anticipatory anxiety over the holidays, and when it finally gets there, it's usually not quite as bad. She's saying, or he's saying, that they're anticipating it, but when they get there, they actually ruin it.
Yeah. So in this case, we have, you know, probably a very, very smart person who gets some chemistry, distraction, outlet through work, through, you know, through having a thing to do with that intelligence and that energy. And when we find ourselves with a lot of idle time, we can struggle with that. It can be surprising what introducing some level of routine into the holidays can do. And that might be as simple as just waking up in the morning and having a minor exercise routine, having a small meditative routine, maybe some journaling. There's a lot of
walking.
Walking works for some people and not others. Sometimes we need intense exercise. Sometimes we like
exercise,
more.
Let's put it maybe, you're saying put some type of routine into the day.
Yeah, it's sort of amazing how our brains are wired for routine. We can wait, if we simply wake up with a list of to-dos and we go and we check them off, this changes our whole neural chemistry. This is very different than sitting with just idle time. Some of us tear ourselves apart worse than others. I am pretty bad. And I know that if I get up and, you know, if I have this kind of sort of unlimited freedom, but if I get up and have focus, I'm amazed at how little routine I need to put back in place to feel very different in a positive way. So this person probably doesn't think that adding a few tasks like that would be enough to offset all this kind of catastrophe. But I would challenge that, and I would say, okay, let's put a routine in place that kind of comes in place of whatever routine happens. But when you're not on vacation, it's possible that we can even mimic some of the routine of the same, you know, when it's a work day. And so we just kind of pick out, and again, it's not like we have to fill 12 hours of our day with intense thinking. It's just getting up, getting started on the right foot, and sort of subtly shifting how we look at vacations. So I love it.
I've never looked at vacations as a lot of fun. It seems like a lot of work to get there, and I don't relax very well. My husband always would give me such a hard time. He was so great. Get on the plane, he's fast asleep, go,
right.
Get just, you know, nap in the morning, nap in the afternoon, just blah, blah, blah. It was so easy for him to do stuff like that. For me, I find the best thing I can do is if I'm going to stay with somebody is to offer to cook or clean or do something helpful. And it just, at least it gives me sort of a sense of purpose. I've accomplished something and it gets me, maybe it's the routine that you're talking about, but I am not one for idleness. I have to be pretty darn sick to go to bed and just lie around. So I had never thought about it, Josh, that way.
You're welcome.
Why vacations are uncomfortable. Now, I had a fabulous time in Italy and Paris, but I was out learning history, and I was cooking also. I cooked breakfast and dinner, and then we would eat out. So I was always either being the navigator, or I was, like when we went through, the Pope. Where's the Pope?
The Vatican.
The Vatican.
We
hired a tour, which was really great. I give you a tip, everyone, if you ever go, sign up for a tour, because instead of waiting 3 hours in the sun or rain, they take you immediately in the back once your tour is ready, and you go in and you don't have to stand out there for hours and hours, and then you go through the tour.
But Italy, so
we did the same thing when we went to Pompeii. We hired somebody. And so those days were really interesting. I mean, we were just filled with questions and learning and driving new places and talking to people. So it wasn't like lying around, sleeping. I mean, we took a nap. We went to churches. We did all kinds of things like that. But it wasn't – I see what I did that made it so much more comfortable.
Good. There's another element within
okay.
this question, which is the idea of here's the social expectation, the kind of general expectation of how I'm supposed to feel at work, how I'm supposed to feel on vacation. And as people who struggle with anxiety, we're just different. And we just need to get used to the idea that this is how I relax, this is how I feel good, and it might not match the culture as a whole, not even close. And you know, generally speaking, the more we're able to accept that, the more happiness we're able to bring into our lives. A vacation for us might look a little different than a vacation for someone else. And what is easy for us is hard for others, if you actually look at your life. And what is hard for you is easy for others. And that's just the deal. And so putting that weight on yourself, like here's how I'm supposed to feel during a vacation, here's what it's supposed to look like, you know, that's unnecessary.
I think we bring out what we need and then work with whoever we're going with so we kind of meet the needs of both people. It's, you know, it's complex when one person is one way and the other person is completely different, but usually you can come to some kind of compromise.
Sure. Generally speaking, there's a price to pay when the internal you is not being represented by the outside you. If you're trying to put on, you know, kind of an image of who I am as whatever, the great partner, the great family member that comes at Halloween or comes at
not
Christmas.
Scared.
And it's surprising how little, though, you can move and be more honest about who you are and how much joy that can bring back into your life. You don't have to constantly fake it all the time. We've done, usually by this point in our lives, we've done plenty of fake it till you make it. We've tried that strategy. And I'm usually about bringing people a little more towards being more genuine, generally speaking.
Yeah. It's amazing, too, how much good it does for other people around you when you do that. Okay, this is kind of a long question, and I don't know how to cut it down, so let me just start reading. Please help me. I need some advice. I've been diagnosed with anxiety and depression a few months back. At first, my partner was all up for helping me. Very supportive. I lost my job just before I was diagnosed. Felt like a complete failure. Oh, boy, to start out that way, that's not going to still do. So now we are always together. Things have changed so much. Now it's like she doesn't care anymore. Oh, I was on citropram, 10 milligrams, then to 20, then to 30. They put me down to 20, and it was making me snappy and angry with myself and not meaning to be mean. But I would take it out on her at times. After a heated discussion, she told me she wasn't happy. This came to complete shock. I know she does all she can to make me happy, but I just can't find it in myself to seem grateful or happy when I really want to show it towards her because I really do love her. Now I'm thinking she doesn't love me anymore because I went through her phone and saw, oh gosh, this person's really good, what she was saying to her best mate about me. We have been, and her best mate were calling me crazy and saying that I'm tapped, and why is it she is still with me, and really hurtful things makes me so feel so worthless. We live together, and her friend said that she thinks she's only with me still because it's easier than throwing me out. I'm heartbroken and have nowhere to go. I really don't know what to do. Everyone looks at me, which makes me scared to leave the house every day. Anyway, I'm now on new tablets starting 5 days ago, and she came to the docs with me and saying she hopes this medication works and changes my mood. I feel like I have to try extremely hard to keep smiling and talking just so she won't leave. What should I do? Whoa.
Man, yeah, okay. Well, I feel like, you know, welcome to my world. This is, you know, these stories I hear all the time.
I can imagine.
You know, just, you know, these simple questions that we see are usually just kind of the surface. You know, if we really get the full picture of people's lives, they are like this. They involve work. They involve our love life, a sense of criticism of others, self-judgment. And we say, okay, you know, let's hold on to that for a second, and I start re-educating people. Okay, you know, this is more like asthma, diabetes. It's a physical disorder. Here is how we treat it. What's so beautiful about this is that it is completely fixable. Underneath these limitations are usually intelligent, creative, wonderful people who make great partners, great employees, business leaders, all, you name it. So it's a matter of simply, you know, we could go down this laundry list like we just went through of all the fears and struggles, and we can just say, hold on for a second. Let's acknowledge what anxiety is. Let's maybe educate our partner as to what it's like to be you. Hard to do, but I can't guarantee that through this experience, the person you were with, you will be with for the rest of your life. But I want to assure everyone that you can succeed in life and find joy and happiness. And that might include a different person. That's possible. If you're open and honest about who you are and that's not a good fit for who you're with, you can move on and still survive this and still get to the other side of this. Probably happier, better life on the other side, though it won't feel like that for a while. You're also exposing in this question the fact that we deal with language issues. So this is more of a British English thing. What he's referring to is citalopram, which you and I would call Celexa. Is kind of half. This is a big chunk of my job is simply translating from these people all over the world. And fortunately, there's the internet. It's a wonderful tool for helping me translate all the medications. Celexa is sort of a common first line of defense in many of the Western European countries and here in America. It tends to work very poorly and very rarely. Again, it's my job to educate people about the realities of that medication. It fits for a very narrow subsection of the anxiety population. I can usually pick out who they are ahead of time, but it will only offer a certain amount of help even for those people. And I just kind of, it's honestly a huge help for me to tell people, here's what we can expect, here's the side effects. If it's working for you, here's what it's going to look like, here's what it's going to feel like. And unfortunately, with drugs in this category, the SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, they are telling you that they take 6 to 8 weeks to even begin to be effective. That's not really accurate. People who struggle with them tend not to get benefit if they struggle right away. I have a whole thing I could do on SSRIs specifically. Well, I would guide someone to maybe look elsewhere in the medical field and find, you know, I've figured out if you're going to do the medication thing, what tends to work, what tends to turn things around. And when we, you know, get people on the right track nutritionally. The Breakthrough Program is amazing for that. Get them on medication that's actually going to be quickly effective if that's the route they want to go. And all of a sudden, the anxiety is, let's say, 60, 70% down. And this usually is, you know, a few weeks, a month, month and a half kind of a process to get to that point. This is not a, you know, college degree, a four-year program. This is, if I haven't, you know, really gotten people on the right track in just a few weeks, I'm not doing my job right. And that's one of the beautiful things about anxiety is that when we do the right things, we actually see pretty rapid change. So we get the anxiety down. The depression is going to take a little longer to recover from generally.
Well, you've got a lot of things on top of that are real things that are happening to him that have added to this depression, you know, like
yep.
losing your job. So it's not just – he might pop out pretty quickly from that depression because well, he did get it together back when he first started, he said, but – it's only been a few months, so
yeah.
It was diagnosed a few months ago. That doesn't mean it hasn't been going on for quite a while.
Yeah, chances are it has been. I don't know whether it had anything to do with his job going away. I would say 50-50 that it did. But, boy, you know, we it's sort of like we're inadvertently weight training. We've been tugging around this incredible weight of anxiety. Even though he's only mentioning a couple months since diagnosis, it might be for years and years and years. And we put the right steps in place, we get that weight reduced quickly, and all of a sudden people feel incredibly strong, incredibly capable. And that's the fun part of what I do, is getting people in just a few weeks to start realizing that they're actually quite powerful, quite capable. And all these decisions about relationships and jobs and judgment about yourself and all that stuff, those are much easier to do when anxiety is not so in your face. When the chemistry of anxiety, like we talked about earlier, is kind of leaving you in this catastrophic mode, that's what it does. You know, you're thinking all or nothing, you know, she's going to leave me, you know, I'm never going to get a job again. We tend to think in this catastrophic way. And when we're able to get the anxiety down, all of a sudden that pattern breaks down and we're able to look at things far more reasonably and make much better decisions. And it's a
she hasn't left, and she's not taking her friend's advice. I mean, her friend is looking out for her and telling
yes,
her, well,
sure.
She should do the best for her. It's not that he's really crazy or tapped or whatever it is and that she should move
right.
out.
British lingo.
Yeah, she's just trying to bolster her friend, and he happened to have been stupid enough to have gotten into her texts or emails or whatever and read that. But the fact that she's still with him and going to the doctor with him, I'd say that she's pretty committed to him and isn't likely to be walking out quickly.
Yeah, we tend to be shocked that people stick with us, but when we are able to step back and really kind of see the big picture about who we are, we're often wonderful people in the big picture. But when anxiety is so dominant in our lives, that we think we are just an anxious person, and that's all we've become, and we bring nothing to the table. And boy, it's a lot of fun to get that kind of out of the way, and all of a sudden see people bloom. I see it over and over and over again. It's what
I know.
I love about what I do.
I know. Okay, next question. Hello, I have been diagnosed with severe health anxiety. Boy, I see that a lot, and I guess
sure. You'll
probably talk about how that happens. I'm on the 2-month waiting list for CBT, probably another country, and I'm on no medication because I don't want to be.
Mm-hmm.
I was having panic attacks too, but they have stopped now. Every day I feel a new pain in my body, and it's totally bringing me down. I tell myself it's nothing and it will go, and then I get a new pain. It's starting to really get to me because I'm too well at telling myself it's okay, yet it still happens. I just want to cry, not because I'm scared anymore, but because it's bringing me down. Help, please.
Yeah. You know, this sounds like generalized anxiety. The fact that you've been able to address your panic attacks is a huge testament to how effective you've been at your own sort of self-training. The cognitive behavioral stuff, when you get there, by the way, that's what the CBT stands for, you'll take to that like a duck to water. That'll be great. You've, whether you're aware of it or not, have probably already been developing the skills on that front. When it comes to the generalized anxiety, that's fixable. But again, there's just not a good plan out there. If there was, we don't need to be on this phone call. We didn't need to make the Breakthrough program. If there was all the answers you needed out there, somewhere between drugs and therapy, maybe even meditation, whatever we kind of think of as what works for struggling with anxiety disorders, we don't need to do this, but there wasn't. And now that this program exists, it's the final missing piece to the puzzle. It answers so many questions. I do this cognitive behavioral work. I understand that world, but I have the great privilege of doing that work when at the same time I'm giving people all the pieces their bodies have been screaming for, and all of a sudden they feel calm, they have, you know, their muscles are relaxed, they sleep well at night, the generalized anxiety is lower during the day, and then the psychological aspect of my job gets 10 times easier. And complicated question. When it comes to the health specific
stuff.
Yeah,
let's talk about the health anxiety.
Yeah.
I see that so often. I think, and Josh, you may correct me because you're well versed in this, but I think it's basically what we call imprinting. If the chemistry is fired off under a certain situation, they've had certain symptoms, when those symptoms pop up, it terrifies them again, you know, and the tracks get deeper and deeper. And so they're just constantly looking for every little thing all the time. And maybe they're not really afraid that those things are going to happen, but probably they're afraid of the chemical reaction in their body that might happen rather than that actual fear. Am I incorrect in that?
It's a little more, it's a twist on that mechanism. And what happens is people are asking the why question probably thousands of times a day. And our brains, let's think of our brain as having a system. It's not really a part, but it's a pattern or a program that really, really wants to answer the why question. We talked a little bit earlier about split brain people trying to answer why they answer a certain way. And they come up with incorrect conclusions. For many of us, we come up with incorrect conclusions about where our anxiety is coming from, as far as people, places, events, all this stuff that we've, what you're talking about, what we've connected to anxiety incorrectly. When we're asking the why question a million times a day, I'm being figuratively there. Literally, it's probably thousands of times a day. Our body is desperately trying to find a feedback loop that answers that question. For some of us, it's actually not health-related, but it's on the same vein. It's more of this kind of like a horrible thought, the thing that you're kind of least likely to do, the horrible thing. You know, there are a lot of people with generalized anxiety will know exactly what I'm talking about. And I'm not going to go into too much detail with it because not everyone struggles with it. But many of us over time have created these kind of what if I did X, Y, and Z and then horrible outcome. And that thought reinforces the idea that, oh, there's where my anxiety is. Your brain would rather come up with, this is why my anxiety is there, or this is why I feel the way I do, than just sit there and not know. And it's not terribly good at finding these very long, rational answers about the chemistry of anxiety and this is what it does to your brain. We tend to say, oh, I have cancer. Feel that lump in my throat? That is cancer. Well, if I have cancer, I should feel anxious, stressed, depressed, all the things I do. But what's interesting about this person, and it's not all that uncommon, is that the moment you create that loop, a lot of people are actually, there's another side of your brain that's challenging that. Well, let's look at that. Do I have cancer? What is cancer? We maybe get on the internet. We look it up. And we actually might, over time, begin to believe that we don't. And instead of your body going, oh, big sigh of relief, we don't have cancer, I feel great, that anxiety still persists because we really haven't gotten to the root of the issue, the root of the anxiety. So if that chemistry is still going to be present, you're going to start asking the why question again. You're going to find another portion of your body that has got something going on, and anxiety is an amazing chameleon as far as changing blood flow throughout your body, as far as inducing pain, acute, chronic pain. It can do just about anything. I generally just tell people, if you wonder whether anxiety can mimic any disorder, the answer is yes. It can do the list is too long of what the fight or flight response can do throughout our body, because it's a system that it is powerful and it controls our whole body. Trust me, whatever you think is a symptom, and the question is, I get this question probably hundreds of times a year, is could this symptom be related to anxiety? And the answer is 99% of the time, yep, that's absolutely something anxiety can do. And sometimes when people wrap their head around the idea that anxiety is a chameleon, very good at changing shape and color, and you begin to realize what you're doing. You're just reinforcing these different cycles and then breaking them down and picking a new one. This is not all that unusual. And it might move around from thing to thing. It might be repetitive. It might go back to the same thing and then come away from it. I've met many different people that dealt with this in different ways. So the way I tend to describe it is it's like your basement and there's water. And water will always seek the low spot. And someone will come to me and say, I'm afraid that I'm going to die, that my anxiety is going to stop me from breathing in the middle of the night or whatever. My panic attack is going to kill me. And I have, early on in my practice, I said, well, let's look at that. Let's look at the physiology of it. Let's make sure that you understand that that physically can't happen. And say I spend a couple of weeks convincing somebody that this physically is impossible. And they run some little tests or they do some independent research and they go, okay, I totally believe you. That doesn't mean that I've won the battle. It just means I've broken down this one circuit. And what I find is, what happens is, like water seeking a low spot on a floor, it just goes and hunts around once it's been kicked out of one area and will set up another pattern. And so that is not a technique that I support. You know, once in a while, if people are already reducing their generalized anxiety but still have this nagging thought, we might work on that. But the real victory is going to come from exactly what the Breakthrough Program does, which is lower generalized anxiety. There's other techniques we can use to lower generalized anxiety, but I generally would say put that on hold, the thinking, the desire to clear up that thinking, and let's work on generalized anxiety, and let's watch that thinking kind of fade automatically when we begin to reduce generalized anxiety. Make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay,
I think we're down to about 12 minutes before I realized that I never told anyone on the call that they should raise their hand and ask a question. So the rule is star 2 on your telephone and you can ask a question. But as we know that we have many people who don't like to talk, and so we don't have any live questions. We just get a lot of them in the emails. So
and
I'm ready
to
again.
Say. If you are hearing this as a recording, we can't answer your
that's true. But
right.
I do answer emails, so and
right.
You do answer emails.
If you want to get to my mom or I, you can find us by a number of ways, emails and calling. And if you email in a question like you're hearing now, we'll try to get to it on our next call.
I don't usually leave people hanging, though, if they've asked a question. Unless it's close to the call, we'll come up with some help in the meantime. So answer it some way or another.
Yes.
If there was one word I hate more than any other word in the world, it's anxiety. The past 6 years have been a struggle for me. I am posting to seek out anyone that may have the same type of anxiety as I do. My anxiety comes and goes, but when it comes, it doesn't last a few minutes or hours. It lasts a long time. I can be okay for 6 months, but one little trigger can set me off for a good while, and when it comes, it always comes back stronger than ever, or so it feels. I've been to the doctor, and they have tried to prescribe meds, but I don't want that, mainly because I can deal with it for months and months normally. When my anxiety hits, it's related to health scares, like the last one.
Yep.
It's always I have cancer or something. Oh, gosh, this is long. Sorry. In relation currently, what set my anxiety to the roof is that I have this weird throat sensation. It doesn't hurt. I can eat and drink just fine, but it feels like something is just there. I don't know if my anxiety caused it or if it caused me anxiety, but it has set my anxiety through the roof again, and the same impending doom feeling that happens all the time has come back. I don't really want to go to the doctor because I don't want to feel stupid or crazy. Oh, boy. or have them say, I need meds. I tried meds once, and it made my anxiety way worse. I was worried all the bad side effects were going to happen. Ugh, it's a vicious cycle. When I feel like this, I feel like I can't breathe. Impending doom feeling. I can't calm down. It sucks. If anyone else feels this way, I would love to find someone to talk to. As having anxiety leaves me feeling like I am so alone during these times.
Well, we know we know more than a few people to talk to who've been pretty much exactly where this person is describing. You know, if you listen to these calls long enough, you know, two-thirds, three-quarters, and then am I the only one? That seems to be a common theme that comes up over and over again, the sense of isolation. And it's understandable in our culture, even other cultures around the world, why we feel particularly isolated when we struggle with this stuff. But no, you're not alone. You're in the company of a few hundred million people on the planet who struggle surprisingly similarly to how you do. You know, this is where you're having an advocate, someone who kind of sits not in one particular camp, comes in handy, and I try to serve this role for people. The idea that, you know, I know about medication, I know a lot about medication, but I am not just going to, you know, go down that. That's not my only toolkit. If people want to do this with or without drugs, that's fine. I just will have a discussion with people about what drugs will and won't do. And simply saying I tried drugs is usually saying I was put on some SSRI, like we talked about earlier, and shock, surprise, I'm not in that 5% that do well on it. I'm in the normal 95% group, and it actually made things worse. That is common. If people go in thinking that that is all that drugs are and do, they'll walk out thinking I'm somehow more messed up than your average person, when in fact, no, that's just not the reality of it. Here is a perfect example of my throat. Could my throat be caused by my anxiety? Throat symptoms are one of the most common I ever hear about. Anxiety is absolutely wonderful about messing with our natural sense of swallowing and breathing and a lot of throat-related stuff. It's of the physical body symptoms I hear about, it's one of the most common ones. So we learn, you know, we educate ourselves about what's really going on here. Good for you that you can kind of get over this and get back to life for months at a time. There's two general strategies that I'm going to bring to bear. One is getting through those bad moments faster. That's, you know, most people aren't calling me when it's been a year since their last issue, and they're just really trying to be proactive about making sure the next one doesn't happen. I always get the phone call when it's happening, and they're beginning to wonder if this one will ever end. You know, people, we tend not to reach out for help when we're doing just fine. We tend to reach out when we're struggling. So when I get the phone call, my first order of business is making sure this person, let's say, can get out of this moment as quickly as possible. And I'm going to throw a bunch of tools at that. And if they're not open to meds, that's fine. There's dozens of other tools we can do. However, if we want to avoid these reoccurring, this is when proactive, day-to-day maintenance is going to come in handy. And this is what the Break Free program specializes in. Not only can it make getting over right in the middle of these acute events go faster, but it makes the long-term probability that you'll have this again much lower. And this is just a few tools that nutritionally you might add into your life on a day-to-day basis. This isn't expensive. Certainly not compared to what anxiety does to us as far as setting our life back. This is stuff, anything in the Breakthrough program you should be, is healthy for you to take on a day-to-day basis anyways. It's going to improve overall health anyways. Absolutely works for health and sleep and general stress, even if we're not in one of those acute moments. But right now, my life is pretty good, but I absolutely take some of the Breakthrough nutrition every day, diligently, because I know I feel better. And it keeps me from falling back. We all have various reasons why we have these huge setbacks. And a big part of my job is teaching people how to switch from reacting to these big setbacks to being proactive, to actually taking care of yourself on a day-to-day basis so that you struggle very rarely. Okay.
I wanted to address something. It's just about over, but I... the sentence that she's not going to the doctor because she doesn't want to, or he want to feel stupid or crazy. We have a couple of things that we've made. There's a booklet coming out, and by the time you listen to this phone call, it should be out. It's called The Three Tricky Truths That Have Kept Anxiety Sufferers Feeling Hopeless, Helpless, and Out of Control. So there's that free booklet that you can download. And then whenever someone buys the Break Free program, one of the things we give them is another product that we made. It's a course. It comes in video and audio, and you can listen or watch it. And it's called Fear Less, Live More, Understanding Anxiety and Developing a Plan for Your Recovery. We always have people, we give them this program as a gift when they start Break Free, and we ask that they listen to it prior to starting the program, before the program arrives at their house, because it gives them an incredible educational base. And I can tell you with certainty that when you finish those two pieces of information, you will know more than at least 95% of all healthcare providers out there about anxiety. So my people, our people, never feel stupid when talking to their doctor again. As a matter of fact, I believe they feel pretty empowered, and I've had some people come back saying that they were laughing at their doctor's answers because they knew so much more, or knew so much more before their doctor knew, when they were trying to help, or therapist or whatever. So those things are available, and they just give you wonderful, wonderful education into what is happening, what you should be doing, you know, why it's happening, why things haven't worked in the first place, you know, why what you've tried before hasn't worked. So definitely get the free booklet and read that. It's pretty simple. It has Josh and my story, and it's interesting. It has stories of other people in it, and it will tell you in general why you have it and what you can do about it. So we're really close. Josh, do you have any more comments before the hour is over?
Yeah, to me, you know, when I hear that stigma that she's referring to, right, that I'm going crazy, that I'll be sort of like thrown in an institution, I think is...
Well, she was saying that she is worried the doctor would think her crazy or stupid. So I think...
you know, my wife works in an emergency room setting, and I should say her job gets her in an emergency room setting all the time in the medical field, and I don't know, a quarter, a fifth, some significant portion of all ER visits are related to panic attacks. So the medical profession, fortunately, is well past this point of having of not seeing this. It happens all the time. They've seen it, you know, they know what this is, and they know that the last thing that would be helpful for you is being called crazy or being institutionalized. That's just not where our system is anymore. There was a time, you know, if we go back into England's asylum system, that it was awful, and that, yeah, there's a reason that we still have that stigma and we have that fear. Fortunately, we're really quickly emerging from that. I don't even care to talk about anxiety as a psychological disorder. I don't really think it is one.
That's our whole premise, is that it's not really a psychological disorder. It's psychological in that we create certain things, and certain things have happened to us. But the basic cause is not a mental disorder, in our opinion, anymore.
Yeah, and I work with a lot of people, and I've come to the conclusion that that is true. It can coexist with other disorders, but, you know, all the people I've heard, all the questions today, this is just straight-up anxiety. Think of it as your body being flooded with chemistry that it doesn't need, and it's going to affect your body and your brain. And is that a psychological disorder? I don't choose to view it that way, and I don't think there's a good reason to keep it in that category. So that being said, feel free to talk to your physicians openly, and use them. General practitioners, they may not be the best source of good guidance, good information. Psychiatrists are better, not that they're necessarily going to have all the answers either, but
The ER doctor is going to give you some quick-acting anti-anxiety medication. You're going to feel better. It's not going to get to root cause by any means like we do, but it certainly feels good. I've been there, and it certainly feels better when that anxiety just slips away, and you've just, in la-la land, it's heavenly, actually.
You know, a conversation I end up having all the time is people who've gone to the ER, been given a basic benzodiazepine, Xanax, it's usually Ativan, or Valium or something, and they say, wow, you know, it works, but I still think I have cancer, or I'm going to be having a heart attack, or whatever. The anxiety is leading to that catastrophic thinking. And I end up saying all the time, well, I can tell you that Klonopin, or Ativan, or whatever, does not alleviate any heart attack symptoms whatsoever. So if you find that when you take this and your heart symptoms go away, or your breathing symptoms go away, or your throat, or your pain, or your whatever the symptom is, I say, now that's pretty much a proof that this is anxiety. That those drugs only work for anxiety. And so that takes a lot of pressure off people. That takes a lot of this repetitive pattern of catastrophic thinking. They go, oh, okay. That makes sense. That's as good as any heart
attack. Both medications will break the cycle of that catastrophic thinking. That's one of the things I find so wonderful.
Yep.
But it's not a long-term solution. That's the problem. You can't take it all day, every day, or you're in big-time trouble. So
it's a good tool. It's good to know it exists.
It's a great tool.
Like anything, I will tell you that if you rely on one tool exclusively, and I don't care what it is, meditation, exercise, kale, if anyone thinks that one tool is going to solve this problem, they're wrong. And if they rely on one medication and think that that's going to be the total solution, that's just not true. This is I always tell people it's going to take about 5 tools minimum, and it's going to be a toolkit that's going to be customized for you. Fortunately, the Break Free Toolkit has a number in there that aren't really available elsewhere, that people won't find out about through the traditional methods. And some of those tools I know in my life are absolutely critical to my well-being. So it's going to take a few things, but the nice thing is when we use a grouping of tools, that none of them are going to wear out. They don't quit working because we're not counting on them exclusively. We're not wearing them out.
Also, they become habits, and that you don't really think about them anymore. I mean, I have the habit of going in the bathroom in the morning and taking my supplements. I have the habit in the evening before I go to bed of taking them. And there's breathing habits and there's exercise habits. I walk the dogs every morning. I mean, they become habits, so it's not a hard job to do.
Right.
So it becomes easy once you just have made them into habits. Okay, Joshua, are you ready?
I just want to mention the habit that I've picked up is over the last 3 months. I'm pretty sure I spend about a half an hour doing these very fast bike rides with my dog. We do these sprints. And I'm down at least 12 pounds. If you saw me, you'd go, oh, you look different. I'm getting a lot of that lately. It's enough to where people are noticing a difference. And I've noticed it helps across the board with everything.
Yeah.
And
I wish I could do that. I can't
basically
physically,
walk the
but
dog.
I would
it's
love
the fast version.
Yeah, the fast version. By the way, Misty is as fast as ever.
Yeah.
That's the dog we're talking about. Okay, everybody, it is time to go. Everybody needs to eat dinner or breakfast,
lunch. In the east.
Okay, so we will again see you the first Thursday of October. Talk to you soon.
All right.
Bye.
Goodbye, everyone.
The moderator has left the conference. The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you.